Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Sam Tannenhaus joins us now, editor of the New York Times Book Review. He has an article in the Sunday Review section called History Versus the Tea Party. Thanks for doing this, Sam. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be with you again, Brian.
And as you and others have noted, those identifying themselves as Tea Party supporters are going as much in the polls for Romney as for anyone else, even in conservative populist South Carolina. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon that you have people who really dislike Romney voting for him now because they think he is the best chance of getting the votes of people they dislike even more in the general election. Well, it's worth remembering that although Romney is consistently winning these early primaries, he's not collecting an overwhelming percentage of the vote. Now, that will improve as candidates drop out, like Governor Huntsman just did, and before him, Michelle Bachmann. But what it points to is a very long-standing conflict in the Republican Party between what used to be called regulars or stalwarts, kind of classic old-style Republicans, and what are really insurgents, radicals who want to take over the party, and they've made it, you know, very clear that's what their agenda is, and drive it to the right. And it's happened many times in recent history, really going back to right after World War II, and periodically we see these resurgences of protest on the right. What makes this one different, and the reason I wrote about it, is that the prior insurgencies, important ones would be Barry Goldwater's nomination campaign in 1964 and Ronald Reagan's two big campaigns in 1976 when he almost unseated Gerald Ford, an unelected incumbent, in 1980 when he actually won, is that those insurgencies were directed from the top to a great extent. There were journalists, pundits, think tanks, intellectuals, all involved in those campaigns. This one, the Tea Party movement, for all the emphasis, I think overemphasis on billionaire funders and AstroTurf organizations and all the rest, is really a very diffuse, splintered movement. So they've not been able to come together behind a single candidate, and we're seeing slices of it in these nomination contests.
Let's take a call from Jack in Ridgewood, who says he's a Tea Party supporter. Right, Jack?
That's correct, Brian. I am.
Thanks for calling in. And I guess you were responding to what I said before the break, the question, really. If occupiers are out in force on Capitol Hill today, in particular the Occupy movement, and elsewhere on different days, why aren't we seeing Tea Party demonstrations in the streets like we did in 2009 and 2010? And you ever thought about that?
Because we're working. I mean, a vast majority of the Tea Party folks have jobs and are working and just really don't have the time to engage in those other types of activities.
Well, yeah, but people did go to the healthcare town hall meetings and stuff, and that's really how they got on the map, by showing up in person, especially in 2009, right?
True, but, you know, I think the movement ebbs and flows, like your guest said, and I really think that people are overlooking the Tea Party as far as a force when the election comes around. Right now, we're just kind of sitting on the sideline seeing who we're going to go for.
What is the heart of the Tea Party message for you at this point?
The heart of the Tea Party message is we've got to stop the spending. I mean, we're just spending way too much money.
Have you landed on a candidate? You live in New Jersey, so your primary wouldn't come until June, so it may well be settled by then. But among the current field, who would you vote for?
Well, that's a difficult question. A lot of us are in a conundrum about that. I mean, look, the ultimate goal is to defeat Barack Obama, so it would probably be the most electable candidate.
Jack, thanks a lot for your call. Keep calling
us.
And let's go right to somebody who says he's former Tea Party, Dan in Rockaway. Hey, Dan, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, good morning.
So tell us about your political evolution with respect to the Tea Party. Did you at first find them attractive?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think I represent a wide segment of people who, during the meltdown, jumped on the bandwagon of the Fox News Tea Party. We got to stop the spending. We're in tremendous trouble. And I think what happened over time for myself and many others is that as you did the research on this and you realize you know, who was really responsible? Companies like Goldman Sachs. Unchecked capitalism that allowed them to, you know, short the market and play games with these mortgages and the CDOs, and the whole background to that gave you a new realization. And then what happened was the second part of it that changed my philosophy was where the focus became from the Tea Party people like your former caller to putting the focus on union workers, firemen, police officers, union people who worked hard and in most ways were tremendously impacted by the loss in their 401ks because of these big corporations. And all of a sudden we were told that we were the reason for the problem and that you shouldn't have a pension. And in some cases, your pension should be taken away from you. So my evolution is pretty amazing to me, because if you would have told me in 2009 that I would hold this philosophy today, I would have told you you're crazy. And, you know, I think that a lot of people similarly to me have evolved. And I think come election time, you're going to see a big shift because of the truth that's coming out.
Interesting.
And while
Dan, I'm going to leave it there and go on, but keep calling us, okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much. And anyone else who would call yourself current Tea Party or former Tea Party, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we talk with Sam Tannenhaus, who wrote the article History Versus the Tea Party in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times. And Sam, you contrasted the relationship to the Tea Party between two conservative media figures, William Kristol on the one hand and Sarah Palin on the other hand. Why did you find them an interesting contrast?
Well, I mean, it's interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, because Bill Kristol and Sarah Palin kind of have a history together. He was one of her early champions and saw her as a number of very smart conservatives, including our own David Brooks at the New York Times, if you look at a very early op-ed column he wrote, as kind of a force for reform and of kind of an anti-establishment figure who might shake up the Republican Party. Then what happened was the Tea Party movement grew up after Sarah Palin's vice presidential run, and she really became its tribune as much as any single person was. And she delivered an address, a keynote address, at the big Tea Party convention held in Nashville in February 2010. And that speech was actually received by David Broder, among others, as signaling a possible presidential run. But if you go back and look, as I did, at what she actually said, she makes it very clear this is a bottom-up as opposed to top-down movement. And that's where someone like Bill Kristol may be a little bit at sea, because he comes out of a tradition of strong alliances among writers, thinkers, intellectuals, and grassroots activists. And the Tea Party, in an interesting way, has driven a wedge between that. It was so interesting to hear the second caller describe his own political trajectory and where he saw at a certain point Tea Party doctrine, insofar as he understood it, seemed to be at odds with middle-class interests. And what the conservative movement historically has been very good at, particularly in the Reagan years and again in the 90s when Newt Gingrich led the Republican revolution that gave him and the Republicans control of the House for the first time in some 40 years, is aligning their ideology with middle-class values and aspirations. And it's not really clear that's happening now. In fact, you could make the case that of the candidates now competing for the Republican nomination, the one who actually is closest to many Tea Party beliefs is Mitt Romney, because what the Tea Partiers have said in polls, they favor Social Security, they favor Medicare. The spending they seem opposed to is spending that goes to other people they think don't deserve it.
Right, and by that token, I wonder if it's really such a new and different kind of conservative movement. I mean, I could look at it as a medium-sized outburst in 2009 of mostly angry white, middle-class, middle-aged, employed, as the one caller called it, pointed out, Republicans, mostly men, in a very traditional role. They didn't want to be taxed to bail out other people who they saw as unworthy for being unemployed or losing their homes or retiring on big public pensions or whatever. And then maybe it was exaggerated by the media. Then the Koch brothers and other big corporate money pockets came in to back them up. And it was very much like Gingrich in 94, an angry white backlash with a newer black Republican in the White House, oh, by the way, putting energy into the existing Republican machine. But you don't think so.
Well, I think that's partly true. I think the first half of it is true. It does fit into a cycle of insurgencies. And the piece describes them and also quotes a very important new book by a brilliant young historian, Jeffrey Cabaservice, called Rule and Ruin, which is about the what he calls the destruction of moderation and of the Republican Party. And yes, what his book describes is a cycle of insurgencies very much like this one. The difference is this divide that opened up between the pundit class on the one hand and the activists on another. I'll give you an example. The debt ceiling crisis last summer in July and the very beginning of August. At that point, what we think of as the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives forced a confrontation between the Speaker, John Boehner, and Barack Obama, and also involving Mitch McConnell, who is the minority leader, Republican Senate Minority Leader. Well, at that point, editorial writers in the Wall Street Journal and publications like the Weekly Standard, which prior to that had been championing the Tea Party, suddenly decided they were a little nervous about it because they were pushing too far. The same thing happened in the early primaries. If a candidate like Ron Paul or Newt Gingrich was actually speaking more directly to Tea Party passions, suddenly the pundits were getting very nervous and rallied around Mitt Romney, whom they don't even like all that much, but were mainly firing at all his opponents because of the fear that once the Tea Party doctrine in its, let's say, purest state was presented to a broad national audience, it looked like a recipe for disastrously losing a national election, a presidential election they thought they could win. And at that point, the that very tightly mortised movement on the right began to disintegrate or dissipate a little bit. And that's really what I think the interesting point we've reached now is, that the Tea Party was never geared up for a national election. Their successes came in congressional district, in a few gubernatorial races. Remember, some of the big Senate candidates they supported lost. Sharon Angle, Christine O'Donnell. The argument could be made that the Tea Party actually cost the Republicans a majority in the Senate and gave us this oddly divided government, which we've never had in modern history, with a president in one of the two chambers. So it's always been a kind of ambiguous movement. What I think is a mistake, however, is to say, oh, it's Fox and Glenn Beck and the Koch brothers, because that raises another question. What that really says is that overlooks what happened in the 2010 elections and says, well, the people who voted for all these candidates were being manipulated. Okay, if that's true, were they also being manipulated in 2008 when they gave Barack Obama the first Democratic majority victory since Lyndon Johnson in 1964?
He had a lot of money.
Are voters only manipulated when we don't like what they do?
Lorraine in Bayonne, you're on WNYC, speaking to one of the points I think that Sam was just making. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. I was a Tea Party supporter from the very beginning, and then when I saw that the people who were voted in by the Tea Party didn't want to raise the debt ceiling, I was very, very surprised. I was a Ron Paul supporter. I even I have their magazine that I get every month or every 2 months, and they have Frank Gaffney being interviewed, and I thought to myself, what is this? I mean, Ron Paul is the guy that started the Tea Party. He's the only guy that's going to clear up this country. And we have all these Tea Parties going for the other fellas. Mm. None of the...
There's the divide. You are a living example of the divide that I think Sam was just talking about between Ron Paul supporters and the Tea Party movement or others in the Tea Party movement, because you now feel alienated because they're going for other kinds of ideas. Lorraine, thank you very much. And Bill in Naugatuck, you're on WNYC. Hiya, Bill.
Hi. I just want to say I think you're selling short the Tea Party. Tea Party has been working on electing politicians to represent their views. And as Tip O'Neill said, all politics are local, so that it wasn't necessarily a national organization, but it will affect the national outcome because they're looking at politicians who are going to represent their values. And unlike the Occupy movement, which is a mob rule, they want to force people, intimidate people to come over to their thinking. The Tea Party people are working through the structure of elections. They're working with the system, and they're doing it the right way. And that's the major difference between them and the Occupy people.
Bill,
can I comment on that?
Yeah, Sam, we're almost out of time, but go ahead.
I just want to say this caller is absolutely right. They are working through the system, and it is an example of citizen politics. Occupy Wall Street is something else. It's protests and demands. What the Tea Party does is the hard work of running campaigns, choosing candidates, taking over precincts, getting the vote out. That's how politics works in this country.
So to bring it full circle to the question, why aren't they out in the streets anymore? And, Bill, thank you so much for your call. Please call us again. And whether people accept or not the idea that Occupy is trying to intimidate people into change, maybe the Tea Party isn't occupying the streets because they don't have to. They're occupying the halls of power, having one effective control of the House of Representatives, and people don't have to take to the streets if they're in charge. They just call a news conference.
That's right. And it would the Occupy Wall Street people would do very well to follow their example.
Sam Tannenhaus is the editor-in-chief of the New York Times book review section. His article, History Versus the Tea Party, was in the Sunday Review this week. Sam, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.